Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. In the opening segment of the program, I'll be talking with Keith Taylor, Anne-Marie Oman, and Steve Amick about a new collection of ghost stories. Then I'll be having a conversation with Jim Harrison about his stunning new novel, The Great Leader. At the end, regular contributor, poet and essayist Fleeta Brown will be here to talk about Jim Harrison's newest book of poetry, Songs of Unreason. We're now well into November, a few weeks past Halloween. There will be lots of evenings over the next several months to kick back, settle down by the fireplace, read a good ghost story or two as the house creaks in the wind, the furnace rattles, and the coyotes howl in the woods. And I have three spectral writers with me today in the studio who will be talking about a new book from Wayne State University Press. The book is titled Ghost Writers, Us Haunting Them. And first of all with me, Keith Taylor.
Good to see you, Aaron.
Yeah, University of Michigan and author of lots of non-ghostly stories.
It's true.
Steve Amick, the author of a number of novels, none of them ghostly.
No.
And finally, Anne-Marie Oman, who needs no introduction, but poet, playwright, memorist, and instructor at the Interlochen Arts Academy, and someone who has never written a ghost story. As far as I know.
No, and written very little fiction.
And, yeah.
So it's kind of a breakthrough.
So, Keith, you are one of the editors on this.
I am indeed, and pleased to be.
How did this all happen?
Laura Kosciuszko and I, Laura had a ghost story in another book. You may have even dealt with this book a few years back. It was, Anne-Marie has a piece in it. It's called Sweetwater, Women Writing from the Great Lakes. It was edited by Allison Swan and published by Michigan State. And Laura Kosciuszko, who is a fabulous novelist and poet, my co-editor on this, had a ghost story in there. And I was teaching the book, and we started emailing back and forth about it. And finally I said, so do you really believe in these things? And she said, oh, of course not. But I've known several people relatively sane who say they've had these experiences. And I said, yeah, me too. So, I mean, that was that sort of, we realized that that was an interesting thing, and everybody had these stories, or everybody knew someone who had these stories.
Anne-Marie, do you have ghost stories?
Oh, there are lots of ghost stories in the rural area where I grew up. You know,
but did you buy into them?
Let's say, as a child, I certainly did. I was terribly afraid of them. I think as an adult, I'm sort of about ghosts. I'm an optimistic agnostic.
Steve?
I don't know if I believe in them, but I do believe that England and Scotland are haunted. but I have in moments you resorted to that thing you're supposed to do if you do think there's a spirit there, like, you're not wanted here, please leave. I've said that out loud in rooms sometimes.
I think we've all had moments where we've gone, wow, this could really be happening, and then we've talked ourselves out of it and talk ourselves into it, and some places seem to lend to that kind of thinking.
So should we talk about stories individually and
absolutely.
Okay. Anne-Marie?
Well, the name of my story is Bitch of Thane, which is a term for Grace's ice and water shield. Right. And The story is about a woman from the Upper Peninsula who's a construction worker, and she has an aunt who's a ghost, who becomes a ghost in the course of the story, and she is a participant in this death by Bitch of Thane. Mm-hmm. And so it's a story. It's called Spider Ghosting is this process, and it's spider ghosts. I'm sorry, this is really complicated.
Whenever you summarize it, it's
difficult. But the spider ghosts were the ghosts who connected things.
Yes.
They put things together like construction workers, thus the parallel. And the story came from actually having built our own home. And David and I were working with Bitch of Thane on a windy day on a roof, and anybody who's ever done that knows that it's just wicked. And although in the story the husband dies death by Bitchethane, but it actually came out of a fear that something bad would happen while we were actually working on this stuff. It was one of those fears that I then projected right out and went, oh, this will work for writing. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. And it was because I was so frightened at that moment while we were working with it on the roof, on the edge of a roof, on a very high roof. And so it came out of that. Setting it in the UP is just that I really like that voice, that country voice, and the kind of roughneck quality of that voice and that character. So that was where it came from. And the ghost part was just this idea of wanting to link things and put things into associations. Maybe I could say more about that, but not yet.
Steve, tell yours.
I ended up writing about Harry Bennett, Henry Ford's muscle, and he had his famous castle not far from my childhood home in Ann Arbor, and we always kind of, there were stories about his pet lions and tigers in the tunnels there, and I became intrigued with...
And those were true stories.
Those are true stories. I always find with ghost stories, for me, I like there to be some element of other possibility for it, so that it can have a narrative arc that has to do with the character. So it's not just that was weird. For me, I'm really intrigued by characters, even nefarious characters, and making this empathetic bridge to them. So it's fun to put yourself in the place of somebody that thuggish and try to figure out what he might feel after having done various stinker-related things for several decades. So that's where my story came from.
And mine, I hate to sound like, I feel like I should get serious for a moment. So, I mean, I think one of the attractions for ghost stories is the fact that with ghosts, the idea of ghosts, we transcend our limits and know greater limitation than our own mortality. So the ghosts allow us to reach past that. So the ghosts then become something that embody or disembody our fears and our hopes. We can project things on them. So my story, I have three guys go into Detroit, and they're afraid of the city. They are confronted by a homeless man, and they're terrified, and a gun goes off. And then they spend the rest of the time trying to figure out if there was a body there.
And it's a fear that is pretty general among people who live in outstate
Michigan.
It is.
And I have a sort of, you know, evangelical mission to convince people who live in northern Michigan, where I also spend a lot of time, that they really don't have to be that afraid of the city. And, of course, the people who live in the city, many of them, are terrified of coming to the north.
No kidding.
Actually, some of them are terrified just of crossing 8 Mile.
They are indeed, absolutely. And given the history, they probably have more reason to be afraid than we do. You kind of hope that we're all a political unit and a historical unit. So, you know, who knows? There are things that are bigger than ghost stories. But ghosts are good for moving along. They all have ghosts.
So we have some time to hear each of you read a bit.
Okay.
Great.
Anne Marie?
Thank you. This is a section in, it occurs in the Loose Talk Bar and Grill, and Peggy has a crush on a local construction worker named Shed Clinton, and this is the first time that the ghost of her Aunt Toots helps her. Then I met Shed Clinton in the Loose Talk Bar and Grill. He's what's called an independent builder, and I thought, well, let's see how far this goes. But after enough bar hopping and construction talk, which I am good at because I do it, we still looked like a moonless midnight without any stars. Then, one night, I'm kind of in my cups with too much cheap Bud Light. I'd spent the day slamming down a floor over some bowed joists, and I had slipped on the glue you put on the joist to reinforce the plywood you are putting down. Fell right through to the basement, and the only thing that saved me was a pile of rolled-up insulation, which, of course, did my own lungs little good. I should have took it for a sign. I was feeling sore and lonely, and all Shed wanted to do was shoot pool. So here's how it went down. He's teetering over the table, sets up, says for me to break, and I send up this thing. My mama might call it a prayer, but it was really just a thought. And then I miss the break entirely, and he just shakes his head like I'm an idiot. I sit down and pop another bud. Before long, I notice this woman on the other side of the bar, and it's my Aunt Toots, just there in the dim light, smoking and drinking her brown liquor. She doesn't look like a debtor, but when she rises, she's like Tyvek in the wind, the way it balloons away from a building if you don't tack it down right. She points her finger like it was a pop gun right at Shed and tips her head like she's asking a question. I don't believe it, but I nod, and she sort of pulls near me and leans over and reaches out her long arm and puts one hand on his shoulder and her other hand on mine. And it's not like wind, more like a kind of cool goo. Not like Spider-Man and all the Marvel comic BS, but a real from the other side ghost superpower from the debtors themselves, coming back to help out, sticking things together like any good construction worker would, making a web. And I can smell the glue I've been breathing all day, and I think, oh, that must be it, some kind of hallucination. But after that, he's all over me. Beautiful.
Ah. Mastic and Bud Light. Right? What a combination.
Fun. I knew where that was going. It was fun to hear it read aloud. So my story, which is called The Man at the Edge, I'll read just a little bit from the middle of it. This is when there is the confrontation. There is the homeless man who comes up to the cars. These guys are slightly lost in the city at a dark corner. The crazy guy from up north, they're all school teachers, but the crazy school teacher suddenly has pulled out his gun and is threatening the man, back away from my car, back away from my car. And the man seemed to fall away from the car just as Mike heard the gun go off. Right in front of him, Mike was driving. His ears rang and immediately felt stuffed with cotton. The scent of gunpowder blew past him toward his open window. The first thing he heard was Eric yell, "Mike, drive, now, right, turn right." He did. He heard his tires squeal as he rounded the corner. "Do you see him?" he asked. "No, man, I don't see anything." Eric yelled as he looked out the back window toward where they'd just been. "Keep driving." Mike saw another small sign directing him right again. He followed it, even though he felt he was going in some kind of weird circle. But this time, he found himself driving down a ramp onto the freeway, cars speeding by at 70 miles an hour. He entered the flow of traffic easily. "Did you hit him?" he asked Dan. "I don't know. I couldn't tell. I couldn't even see him after the gun went off." Dan was breathing hard now, and he sounded frightened. "I have to get rid of this." He started rolling down the window. "Not here." Mike reached over and stopped him. "The gun's registered under my name. They'd find me in a minute." All the signs were suddenly very clear. I-96 to Lansing. They followed the interchanges easily and moved out of the city, through the suburbs, speeding out to the countryside, where the night was very dark and quiet. "You didn't see the guy?" Mike finally asked Eric, who had been quiet since they left the city. "No. I looked. I thought he'd be on the street, you know, lying there." Eric sounded as if he was going to cry. "But I couldn't see him. It was so dark there, man. I even looked up on the sidewalk, and I couldn't see him." "Maybe I didn't hit him," Dan said. "It was like he disappeared. Like he wasn't even there."
Ah, thank you.
Mine's called Not Even Lions and Tigers, and this is from the opening, and at this point, he's not in the castle in Ann Arbor. He's at his other fortified place, which is in Clare County. It's now a Boy Scout camp. Harry Bennett put two and two together, and what he came up with, he was none too crazy about. Sure, it made perfect sense that his hunting lodge now had a full-blown infestation of haints. Hindsight and all, it stood to reason, and he had to kick himself a little for not catching on sooner that this might be the deal. Those monkeys they'd rubbed out right there on the property, he probably should have taken care of a little farther away from the main building. Or at least worn some kind of a hex, maybe a potion. There were plenty of boys in the Ford Service Department who knew a thing or two about a thing or two in that line, having come up from the hills and hollers of Kentucky, Tennessee, Chattanooga, all those southern-type states where they still had witches operating, not like where he was raised, a college town with science and reason and all the very latest forward-thinking beliefs and theories. Yeah, those southern bumpkins working for him likely could have come up with something, hoodoo-wise, to ward off spirits beforehand, if they'd thought of it at the time. But no one had raised the issue. No one had said one word, and now the joint was lousy with haints.
Ah. Okay, Anne-Marie Oman, Keith Taylor, Steve Amick. Ghost Stories. If listeners want to know more about this book, Keith, what should they do?
Well, they can go to Steve. Steve Amick did a beautiful book trailer for this.
A book trailer.
Do they have the link up on the website?
The Wayne State University Press will have the link up. So go to Wayne State University Press website.
WSU Press.
Is that
.com,
it?
Yeah.
.com. Okay. Go there and they can find out all about it. They can link to this fabulous video trailer that Steve made about the book, and they can find out where we're going to be pushing it and things like that.
Okay.
Or they can just order the book.
They can order the
book. Or they could go to any of the Traverse City bookstores and buy it, because the Traverse City bookstores will have it.
It's through the whole region, I think.
And it is indeed. Through the whole state. It is indeed. Through the whole region.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Listeners to this program know that the majority of the interviews we air are recorded in the studio at Interlochen Public Radio. This interview, however, was recorded over the phone. We made several attempts to get a good phone line, but in the end had less than sterling results. That said, I trust you'll find his comments about his own work and writing in general intriguing. Jim Harrison. With Legends of the Fall, you thought about the story for half a dozen years and then wrote it in 9 days, changing one word. And I was wondering, with the newest book, The Great Leader, had this been percolating in your head for some time, or was it something you started after completing The Farmer's Daughter?
Well, they all overlap is the problem, so nothing is very clear. You know, as the way opposed to the way novelists are supposed to think, they don't really think very, it's not very linear, this whole thing. You know, in fact, there's a wonderful book by Edelman called Neuro-Darwinism, how the brain heart actually works, and different kind of leaps and backtracks and so on. So in this case, I thought about this one for a fair amount of time, but it never happened again. Like it did in Legends of the Fall, that directly, you know.
Yes.
But, so I thought of this for a while, and I continued to be fascinated by the milieu in the Upper Peninsula, because you can see life a little more clearly, you know, when it's not so densely populated. That's the same reason why I ended up writing about Nebraska, for the same reason Western Nebraska's rather sparsely populated, so you can see the whole society at once, the whole culture, you know, where that's no longer true of northern Michigan, say from Clare to the Straits, has gotten more crowded and more confusing.
Well, I notice how much you use place, and especially that place in northern Michigan around Grand Marais. It's almost a character.
Yeah, well, you also, it's so easy to see historically, you know. Then you had the, the logging and the mining first and logging and that's pretty much the story, you know. It's the economic, sort of laid the place waste, you know. So what we have is sort of leftovers, but quite beautiful leftovers, you know.
Your detective in that book, Detective Sunderson, and I'm saying this because you capture the economics of that area so well, really feels good about himself because as a state policeman, he's one of the most affluent people in that area.
Oh, well, you know, if you have a job, I remember years ago when the economy was a mess like it is now, they had an opening for a UPS man, and they had about 300 applicants. You know, that would be considered a very good job, you know. So it is close to the bone. I know in Grand Marais, where I had a cabin for 25 years, it was technically poor, but people got along, you know, sort of mutual aid, you know.
Yes.
Helping each other cut wood, you know. Houses were rated by how much wood a house needed. You know, they'd say that's a sturdy cord house, you know.
Yes.
But, so it's pretty hard work and amazingly cold and amazingly a lot of snow. I remember one year it was 300 inches, you know, and the, lake stayed sort of part. There was still ice in the harbor in May, you know.
Yes.
So, but if you have heat and water, you know, you can generally get through. Okay.
In Dalva and The Woman Lit by Fireflies, you assumed a female narrative voice.
Yeah.
Was that especially hard?
Well, you know, I once wrote a piece for the New York Times magazine how I was able to acquire the woman's voice, and I said, well, I grew up with a couple of sisters and five aunts, and I have female horses and dogs and female chickens, so... I gradually can acquire, you know, it's been pointed out, we're all conceived female, you know.
Yes.
And Jung said, what have we done with our twin sister whom we abandoned at birth, you know? The culture tends to determine the play of your character, you know. So males think they should be decidedly male and vice versa. So I think it's not impossible to imagine what it's like to think as a woman, you know.
Yes. Well, this year you have two books, the novel we've been talking about, The Great Leader, and a book of poetry, Songs of Unreason, but I know those had to be finished probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. What are you working on now?
What am I working on now? Well, I'm finishing a book of novellas, which has one more brown dog. And then a novella about a failed artist, which I always found fascinating, you know.
Yes.
Someone who quits and starts again, you know, a painter. And then a third novella that I'm currently working on is called The Boy Who Loved Water, about young man growing up in northern Michigan who's totally obsessed with water, and he starts swimming as a baby and he never stops. He's raised on an island in a river with a small farm, so that's the nature of his life, is water. since we got so much about Michigan, I wrote an early poem called The Syrian Practice of Rivers, so I'm back in the water now.
Well, we will be looking forward to that. I'm talking with Jim Harrison from his home in near Livingston, Montana. Thank you, Jim. Well, Jim, I have been a loyal reader of yours since you appeared with Robert Traver, John Volker at the Hemingway Society.
Well, I don't know. I knew Volker not well. We'd fished a couple times and had a bunch of drinks together. You know, Michigan creates the odd creatures. It's just like my knowing Peacock and using him and Dalva to explain the landscape of the Southwest, you know.
Yes.
Because he has... he's fun to camp with. We've camped all over, including New Mexico, because he has such a broad knowledge of all the flora and fauna and Indian history. But we agreed, what's the point in going someplace unless you've read up on it, you know, and know where you are. People largely don't have any idea where they are, you know, historically or botanically. So it's fun to be with people who do.
So do you write poetry at the same time you're doing fiction?
Well, no, I don't know. I agree with Peter Matheson, who's a friend, that fiction's much more difficult to write than nonfiction. But I don't think of poetry as difficult. It's just what I do. And I suppose it's equally as complicated as fiction, you know. Although you can get quite a space in fiction where you write very well and it seems easy, but then that stops, you know.
Yes. Do you write poetry almost every day?
No, I just have a look at it every day because, as the French poet René Char said, you got to be there when the bread comes fresh from the oven, you know.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting point, you know.
Yes.
You have to be in a state of readiness. So that's your primary fidelity as an artist, is to stay in this state of readiness.
So will there be a new book of poetry in the near future?
Oh, yeah, I'm started again, but it'll be a couple years probably. I've written an awful lot in the last decade, but my nervous exhaustion got me a severe case of shingles that's lasted 11 months now, so it's very uncomfortable, you know.
Yes.
I write longhand and then send her my work by fax, but I'm not computer literate. I just realized there's one more thing I didn't need to know, you know.
Joyce told me you send her about 8 pages at a time.
Well, you know, she's so efficient. So this technological age has some benefits, you know.
Yes.
I mean, if I can just fax her my work and she types it and sends it back, because I write longhand, but I can't tell if it's any good unless it's in print, you know.
Yes.
Because that's my print is our habit, you know. So it's worked this long, so I suppose it will continue to work.
So do you do many revisions, or are you sort of done after she types it up?
Well, that's the advantage of a computer in the long run, you can revise endlessly. And I found that was true when I first, when I was still writing screenplays, see, you can do all this revising without having to retype the whole thing, which is, you know, I wrote Wolf with one finger, which is no fun on an old upright Remington. So after that, I went back to longhand. I screwed up my typing hands by working with cement blocks, so they never worked very well again, you know. It sort of brutalizes your musculature in your hands, you know. But this is okay. The new novel is doing fairly well, I'm pleased to hear.
It's I couldn't set it down. I stayed up all night and read it.
Yeah, Morrow Sunderson, huh?
Yeah. I really identified with him.
Yeah. Well, he has that sense of a sort of moral outrage about this group, and that's why he's in there, you know. It was funny researching cults because you have Joyce, and another person I have working for me out here, raised hundreds of examples of cults on the computer, you know. But there's a commonality, you know. There's a wonderful writer in Michigan at U of M, a scholar called Philip DeLoria, who wrote a book called Plain Indian. His dad was that famous Indian scholar who wrote Custer Died for Your Sins. But Philip's book, Plain Indian, cults often imitate Indian rituals, you know. That's our way of continuing to rip off these people. So we imitate Indian rituals to make the cult seem mysterious, you know, because that's what gets people. Because I was interested in the connection between money and religion, you know, and sexuality, which is always a real mud bath. There's a scarcely a cult or religion in the history of mankind where the old guys don't get the young girls, you know.
Yes.
That's even in that Warren Jeffs thing, you know. It's amazing how similar they can be, you know. They're all over the landscape, just like King Strang out on Beaver Island, you know.
Yes.
So I found it very interesting to why we behave that way. And also, sexuality in the non-traditional culture is always a mud bath anyway, you know. So it was a rich fodder for a novel, you know. And I was amazed by talking to police and detectives and so on, how much they hate domestic abuse, you know, to deal with it. You know, it's so widespread and so utterly horrifying. People beating their wives or kids, have a religious reason for beating their kids to death lately.
Well, I liked the way Sunderson showed great restraint when dealing with Mona.
Well, yeah, I like that. He's a scholar, so he sits in his study and he pulls out that one book, Plotkin's book about violence in America, and he can see the girl next door. That kind of thing can be hard to resist, I suppose.
But he just looked, nothing more.
Yeah, well, he... But the important thing is he doesn't do anything, you know?
Yeah.
That's the moral obligation, is to... The civil contract is to behave, or the whole world falls apart. But people aren't very good at it. You know, well, I don't know. I'm sitting in this room now with a couple thousand books, so I'm not quite sure I went wrong by reading so much, but I started early. That was our family wasn't a scholarly family, but the house was full of books, you know.
Yes.
I find writing students now really underread, because it seems if you're going to be a writer, you're obligated to know all of the classic Western literature and also Chinese poetry, so you better get busy. And I don't see why in creative writing they read each other. You're missing the point. How are you going to learn anybody's thing if you just read each other? You want to read the great ones first, you know?
Yes.
I think, anyway. Nobody's asked me recently, but I feel free to give my opinion on everything, huh?
I think we're at a point of life where we have a right to do that. Well, I'm going to let you go because you have been very generous with your time.
Okay. Well, nice talking to you. What's it like there today?
We're getting ready for the gales of November, so... It's going to be going.
I don't know. A couple of years ago, I was back in the UP, which I still visit. I went up to visit Mario Batali last summer because we're doing a food book together. And then I went to the UP and stayed at Marquette because I love to stay in that big, tall hotel over the harbor.
Yeah.
But, I was thinking that it's still such a wonderful place, I can't resist it. But I have to deal with homesickness because our daughters were out here and our grandchildren, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. But when I was hunting up there in October 2 years ago, I had a friend from Montana and he looked out the window. Said, where's the car? And I looked out and I couldn't see it either because it was October 5th and it was covered with snow. Yeah. I said, well, sort of an indoor day. Oh, well, you can always go to the bar, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, okay, be good.
I'll do my best. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Take care. Bye-bye. Fleeta Brown is here, and we'll have a review of Jim Harrison's newest book of poetry.
Hi, Aaron. I'm glad to be here.
It's interesting. Jim Harrison is so well known as a prose writer, as a writer of film scripts, but he's also an enormously productive poet. And to a well-known poet like you, it's hardly a news flash that poets are not as well known as fiction writers.
Right. If you go in any bookstore and look for the poetry section, it's going to be back in the back corner someplace, in the dusty back corner someplace. This is, there was a time in history that poetry was somewhat more in front of things. And if you go way back in history, of course, you've got there. Poetry was in the court, the king's court, and it was terribly important. But generally, poetry
it was a way of what?
It was a way of telling the story of a person's culture.
Yes.
You know, you have the epic poem like Beowulf, and you've got in Homer, you've got ways of telling the cult. But that's not our culture's way of telling its story these days, although certainly its story is there if a person looks. But poetry, this is a very loud culture, and poetry is a very quiet medium. It's a very quiet genre. It requires a lot of white space around it, and that white space is something that most people have trouble finding.
But it's interesting, and I'll just talk about local writers, people like you. You're primarily a poet, but now you're moving more into prose. We have Anne Marie Oman, who is a poet, but she's doing memoir and other things. We have Jack Driscoll, who was primarily a poet, who continues with that, but has also moved on to do very long pieces of fiction and short stories. What do you learn from poetry that then plays into your fiction writing?
Well, good question. I think that every line of prose I write is really a line of poetry that I'm simply transposing into another form. It's not so much a matter of what I learn as it is that I'm trained myself to pay just exquisitely close attention to language. And so if the language is goes all the way out to the end of the line or doesn't go all the way out to the end of the line, I'm still paying an attention to it. Now, that isn't the distinguishing quality of prose and poetry, but it has a lot to do with the way I guess I think about it when I'm working.
And in my conversation with Jim Harrison, I asked him if he wrote poetry every day, and he said he didn't, but he looks at it every day.
Yeah, I think that I don't want to make it too mystical because people tend to do that, and I think it's kind of damaging to poetry to think of it that way. But I think when poetry really is almost a transmission rather than a learning. And the more poems you read, the more that kind of sense of what a poem does and can do is transmitted. Because after all, a poem tends to be about the things that we can't say. And so if we can't say it, then all we can do is kind of transmit that vision, that way of seeing the world from one poem to us or from one poem to another poem. So, yeah, I can't ever write anything unless I've been reading a great deal.
So Harrison's newest book of poetry.
Yes.
Songs of Unreason. And he says that there is another one on the way, by the way.
Wow. All right. Well, I thought of a poem by W.S. Merwin that I'd like to quote for you as a way sort of into talking about Harrison's poetry. It's called Worn Words, and it goes like this. The late poems are the ones I turn to first now, following a hope that keeps beckoning me, waiting somewhere in the lines, almost in plain sight. It is the late poems that are made of words that have come the whole way. They have been there. Merwin is 84, Harrison is 10 years younger, but both poets' words have come the whole way, which is, I'm sure, part of why I respond to both of them the way I do. We all know Jim Harrison around here. He was born in Grayling and lived in Michigan for years before he moved to Montana and now also Patagonia, Arizona. The world knows Jim Harrison. His books have won all sorts of awards and have been translated into 22 languages. His novels, as you mentioned, have been made into several big movies. he's really interesting to write about. Reviewers like to review Jim Harrison, not just for his books, but for his character.
He is an incredible character.
Yeah. He chain smokes American Spirit cigarettes, even between courses at dinner, I'm told. He's a gourmet cook of his own wild game. Even with his recent diabetes, he downs a glass of vodka every afternoon. Again, I'm told that. You know, he's mostly blind in one eye, which gives him a kind of cockeyed, wild expression. He keeps a poem next to his desk by the 14th century Zen Buddhist poet Musō Sōkeki, and it goes like this. It would be merciful for people not to come calling and disturb the loneliness of the mountains to which I have returned from the sorrows of the world. Harrison, in spite of all the money and fame he's gotten from his fiction, considers himself first of all a poet. That's interesting. I don't know if our audience knows that. In the introduction to The Shape of the Journey, a collection published in 2000, which draws from his first 8 books of poetry, he writes, "This book is the portion of my life that means the most to me. Poetry is totally uncontrollable. You don't have any idea when it's going to emerge and when it's not going to emerge. I've never stopped writing it. You can put off a novel for a while, but you can't not write a poem because that particular muse is not very cooperative." As I was reading Songs of Unreason, which just came out from Copper Canyon Press, I was thinking about where Harrison's poems have come, where along the whole way they seem to be. His collection before this one, Saving Daylight, is full of his usual rich conversation between the natural world, rivers and wolves and egg yolks, and the transcendence they contain. I'll say nothing has changed in the new book except that the light of awareness that's infused all of Harrison's work is brighter here. What do I mean by that? I mean that the poems, as the title implies, are songs of unreason. They're singing more than they're telling stories, and they've taken an even more deliberate step off the cliff of reason. That doesn't for a second mean that he's not holding us in mind as readers. He's too authentic to play with language that leaves us behind. The world is too grand to reshape with babble, he says in one poem in this collection. I'll give you a poem to show you what I mean by the singing and by the step off the cliff. Here's the first poem in the book. It's called Broom. To remember you're alive, visit the cemetery of your father at noon after you've made love and are still wrapped in a mammalian odor that you are forced to cherish. Under each stone is someone's inevitable surprise, the unexpected death of their biology that struggled hard, as it must. Now to home without looking back. Enough is enough. En route, buy the best wine you can afford and a dozen stiff brooms. Have a few swallows, then throw the furniture out the window and begin sweeping. Sweep until the walls are bare of paint, and at your feet sweep until the floor disappears. Finish the wine in this field of air and return to the cemetery in evening and wind through the stones a slow dance of your name visible only to birds. There are so many ways to talk about this poem. The visit to the dead father after just making love. It appears that if we're going to really live, we need to dwell among what we thought were opposites. And we must do it. We must really live. Buy our bottle of wine and sweep out everything that's getting in the way of our clear perception, getting rid of even our own self, our own name. We need to dance in the cemetery. Okay, that's the blank slate or swept out space that he starts with. The long sequence that immediately follows is called Suite of Unreason. That's S-U-I-T-E, based on, of course, the title of the book, Songs of Unreason, which is printed in a different typeface on the unnumbered verso of the pages and goes on for the rest of the book, except for the final poem. So you have named poems on the octavo pages and these short little poems on the verso, little bits of unreason breaking in on the other. Here's an example of a couple of these. The moon is under suspicion. Of what use is it? It exudes its white smoke of light. Okay, here's another. Late October, and now I wear a wool cap around the clock, take 3 naps a day. I've no clear memory of why this happens, something about the earth tilting on an axis. Yesterday, 23 sandhill cranes flew north. Why? These little poems remind me of the ones in, they're very much like the ones in Braided Creek, the 2003 conversation in poems that Harrison and Ted Kooser wrote back and forth to each other. They're aphoristic sometimes, sometimes more like haiku. They mirror moment by moment the movement of the mind. But I don't think we want to take these poems and the ones on the numbered pages opposite as counterpoint to each other. Here's where I want to talk about the flavor of this book as a whole. This book is an evaluation. It evaluates the issue of death, the way we see death, not death itself. It does not wish to solve the problem of death, and it doesn't mean to provide a guide for those coming along. The poems just look at death with Harrison's clear, compassionate eye. Here's a poem. It's called Dan's Bugs. I felt a little bad about the nasty earwig that drowned in my nighttime glass of water, lying prone at the bottom like a shipwrecked mariner. There was guilt about the moth who died when she showered with me, possibly a female. They communicate through wing vibrations. I was careful when sticking a letter in our rural mailbox, waiting for a fly to escape, not wanting her to be trapped there in the darkness. Out here in the country, many insects invade our lives, and many die in my nightcap, floating and deranged. On the way to town to buy wine and a chicken, I stopped from 70 miles per hour to pick up a wounded dragonfly fluttering on the yellow line. I've read that some insects live only for minutes, as we do in our implacable geologic time. There we are, in the middle of implacable geologic time, living only for a minute in comparison. Harrison looks at this, just brings this to awareness, along with our awareness of the life around us. And the more we see, the more we see damage, the damage done to us and the damage we've done. Here in this late collection, everything is forgiven, or rather, there's nothing to forgive. Here's a poem about that from this collection. It's called Corruption. Like Afghanistan, I'm full of corruption. My friend McGuain once said, I'd gladly commit 100 acts of literary capitulation to keep my dogs in Alpo. The little ones needed dental braces and flutes, cars and houses. Off and on, I've had this dangerous golden touch like a key to a slot machine streaming $20 gold pieces. It was so easy to buy expensive French wine that purges the grim melancholy of livelihood, the drudgery of concocting fibs. I know a man, happily married, who bought a girl a $100 pair of panties. I was stunned. For this price, I buy a whole lamb each fall. Now lamb and panties are gone, though the panties might be on a card table at a yard sale. Right now, a wind has come up and there's a strange blizzard of willow buds outside my studio. I'm on death row but won't give up corruption. I've waterboarded myself. I'm guilty of everything. This would be a good place to say something about Harrison's sense of humor. It's always there, that kind of bemusement. It seems as if, to me at least, it's the only way we can see both dark and light, and see them at the same time and love them both. The final poem of the book is called Death Again. It begins like this, and I want you to hear these because I read the first poem, and then I'm just going to read the beginning of the last poem because they function in the collection like bookends. It's important. It's an important setup for the whole interior of the book. It starts like this. Let's not get romantic or dismal about death. Indeed, it's our most unique act along with birth. We must think of it as cooking breakfast. It's that ordinary. Break two eggs in a bowl, or break a bowl into two eggs, slip into a coffin, and then he goes on from there. The first poem in the book might lead us to misunderstand and think that when we sweep out everything, we get to live in some kind of woo-woo world of the spirit. But the poems never for a moment allow us to float off into the stratosphere. Harrison drags us back here over and over. We have to live here where everything happens. You know, Aaron, always when I look at a poet's late poems, I'm asking myself, has the poetry come along? How is it different from the earlier poems? Has it turned toneless and flat? Does it repeat itself? Has the poet created a caricature of himself? In this collection, Songs of Unreason, I want to say, in the words of the poet D.H. Lawrence, look, we have come through. These are beautiful poems that scrape raw bone and at the same time move into the secret spaces that words only know how to point to. Harrison's language is sure and ordinary. It's the language of a man who knows where he's stepping, and each step is not so much deliberate as it is led by all he has been and is now. I'm deeply grateful for Jim Harrison's poems.
You know, and it's so interesting because his prose also just continues on. It is strong. It is just more mature.
Yeah, it's what we could all wish for.
All wish for. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Keith Taylor, Anne-Marie Oman, and Steve Amick. My special thanks to Jim Harrison for his time and patience in dealing with the cranky phone connection. Also, my thanks to Brock Mormon, Brad Aspey, and Peter Payette. And finally, to Fleeta Brown for her thoughtful review of Jim Harrison's newest book of poetry. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next month to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.